Great, as always. And now I'm happy to have Mike Sagg, who is one of the co-chairs of the Ryan White Clinical Conference, talking about application of antiretroviral therapy. Mike? Yep. He's miking. Mike is miking.
Good morning. It's great to be here. I was just listening to the questions, and I realized this is more than 101, but we're going to go there anyway, right? So a lot of the questions I'm going to go over today are some of the basics, but they'll be repeated, a couple of the questions, in the larger session. The difference will be this time through it's just going to be me. The second time through there'll be a panel, and it'll be interesting to hear the differing opinions and responses when we have the panel up there. So disclosures, a consultant for these companies as well as PI on some of their studies. So we're going to talk about starting therapy, what to do with persistent low-level viremia, one of the types of questions that just came up, a little bit about pregnancy, and that's a moving field, and then people experiencing virologic failure. So there's guidelines everywhere. This is the HHS guidelines, which are up to date. And in fact, this week, the perinatal guidelines are just updated, so you can go check that out. And that, as I mentioned earlier, with pregnancy is a bit of a moving target. And then the ISUSA guidelines, which have been going on since 1996 every other year in JAMA, these just came out over the summer. I'll be referring to both as we go through, and there are some subtle differences, minor differences I'll try to point out along the way. So, initiate as soon as possible, and the question came up that we didn't ask the group, but it was a question about rapid start. I think the take-home point is we want to start pretty quickly, and there's two reasons for this. One, you could argue that biologically you want to get things on board, and also the sooner somebody becomes undetectable, the less likely it is that they're going to transmit. Okay, great. Then this business of starting on the same day as diagnosis, and we're going to talk about that later in the conference. But I personally don't think that's essential. It's nice if you can do it, but it takes an awful lot of effort. In our clinic, it's pretty disruptive. We do it, but we'll have a great discussion about that with the panel. The other things, if you're going to do the initiation right away in the clinic, that means you can't have an RNA level before you treat or a CD4 count or a genotype, and you don't have HLA-B5701, so it means that you're pretty much restricted to a tenofovir type-based regimen with an unboosted integrase inhibitor or boosted darunavir. And then the N and RTIs you don't want to use up front. Rilpivirine might be a little bit of an exception, but still you might have transmitted resistance to that. But the take-home point is you just want to start fairly quickly. And the second reason I didn't get to, which was by treating early, earlier after diagnosis, you have a better chance of somebody keeping their first appointment. So the time between diagnosis and first visit, let's say they're diagnosed at the health department referred to you, the longer that takes, the less likely it is they're going to show up. So getting it done pretty quickly is important. So what should I use as initial therapy? Got a 48-year-old guy, newly diagnosed, asymptomatic, viral load 28,000, CD4 count 650, B5701 positive. Now, this is not an immediate start. This is a week and a half after diagnosis. Genotype comes back wild type, normal renal function, okay to start therapy if you think he should. And there we go. So you can pull out your phones. I think you might want to look through these. While you're looking, I'll just talk. It can be tenofovir with low dose of efavirenz in the generic form, which is now available. Just a dolutegravir or 3TC alone. Abacavir-based dolutegravir, TAF-based dolutegravir, COBI with elvitegravir, BIC, et cetera. Go ahead and vote. Okay. So most people went with a either a BIC or a dolutegravir regimen. Importantly, very few people picked, in this case, the abacavir, and that's good because there was a B5701 positive. Otherwise, that would be an okay choice here, right? And we'll talk later in the conference about dolutegravir 3TC, which also would be a decent choice, believe it or not. And then ropivirine could be good. So there's a lot of really good options here. David just went through the different types of drugs, but as far as the guidelines go, in both sets of guidelines, a integrated strand transfer inhibitor is really the anchor drug for the recommended regimens, and then you could vary the backbone a little bit. In the HHS guidelines, the raltegravir with two tablets, 600 milligrams once a day, plus tenofovir-based regimen with intracitabine is also recommended. And these are data that just came out in Amsterdam that shows there's not a whole lot of difference. You can be the best statistician in the world, and you can't tell a difference here. It's pretty superimposable. And I might add, the key thing, look how successful it is. It starts to, without it being a cure, it starts to look like hepatitis C therapy in a way. Now, a lot of people, this is supposed to be the 101 course, so I'm going over some 101 things, but the big difference between TDF and TAF, this is a 300 milligram tablet, this TAF is a 25 milligram tablet, and what that translates into is you need higher plasma levels of TDF to get to tenofovir inside the cell, whereas TAF has much lower plasma levels but still gets inside the cell at roughly equivalent levels of the active compound of tenofovir. And so the activity, antiviral activity, is still just as strong but with a lot less plasma level. And it's viewed that the plasma level is really the key to some of the adverse events. I might also add that a lot of the things that we're most concerned about, for example, bone or kidney trouble, is really accentuated when tenofovir DF, TDF, is used with a booster, like boosted darunavir, COBE, or with ritonavir, and you don't see it quite as much when you really start to parse. So I think a lot of the energy around, oh, you got to use TAF as opposed to TDF, I think some of that needs to be tempered with the concept that the boosting has really accentuated that toxicity profile, although in the longer run, perhaps TAF would be safer. So the second question, guy shows up. This time his viral load is really, really high. CD4 count is low. He's B5701 negative in this scenario. Everything else is pretty much the same. Does that change what you think? So same listing of options here. Let's go ahead and vote. Okay, let's see what we got. Okay, so again, good options, good choices. The one that you don't want to use here in particular, unfortunately, is this ropivirine because it's not going to be active above 100,000 copies in general. But I think everything else that you all have selected, the dolutegravir 3TC works pretty well between 100,000 and 500,000 with no mutations, but that much higher, you might be a little bit hesitant, but I can't say it's wrong exactly. And the other thing to remember, normally we think about abacavir being not a great choice if the viral load is greater than 100,000. That rule is off the table when it's paired with dolutegravir because the data have shown that when you have dolutegravir as the anchor as opposed to, say, a boosted PI or a non-nuke, that the 100,000 rule is out. And here are some more data looking at greater than 100,000 copies from that same study, and you can see that there's really not much difference between them. And note in particular here, this dolutegravir abacavir 3TC in the dark black line really did quite well. And so this is the bottom line. What are we going to be using most? And I think the voting that you just showed confirms that you're thinking exactly like the guidelines suggest. One new agent we'll talk about later in this conference is doravirine that was just approved. It's a non-nuke that has a pretty broad activity range, especially when resistant viruses are present in an RTI-resistant viruses. We'll hear more about that as the conference goes along. Rilpivirine is still a great choice for a lot of patients as long as the viral load is less than 100,000. All right, so here's a question. And this was on your pretest, and I hate to say a lot of people didn't get this correct. So you get another shot at it. Maybe you'll change the right answer to a wrong one with that preface. Which of the following drugs is most likely to cause a 0.1 milligram per deciliter jump in serum creatinine 1 week after starting therapy? And I would add that occurs in almost every patient. So let's go ahead and vote. Okay. All right. You did better this time, but actually the answer is A, or number one, is bictegravir. And everyone said, wait a minute. Tenofovir causes creatinine trouble. Well, it does in some people, but usually not within the first week. And it doesn't cause it in almost everyone. You say, well, why is that? Why is bictegravir right? So this goes back to something that I was not taught in medical school. And for those of you who are younger, you may have been taught this. But when I was in medical school, creatinine clearance was all through the glomerular filtration, right? So creatinine got cleared and it got into the urine, and that's that. And therefore, you can even estimate GFR by looking at serum creatinine. We do it all the time, eGFR. But a funny thing happened on the way to GFR. There was discovered that in the proximal tubule, there's actually some enzymes that secrete creatinine from the bloodstream into the urine, on top of whatever the glomerulus filtered. And in this case, there's an enzyme here called OCT2. Now, that's easy for me to remember because my birthday is October 2nd. So every time you see OCT2, you should think of me and send me a card. Say, hey, OCT2. All right. But if you inhibit OCT2, so both bictegravir and dolutegravir do that, dolutegravir inhibits a little bit more, so it might be 0.15. serum creatinine increase. And then I also added here that cobicistat inhibits the same type of process but a different enzyme called MATE1. So if you're from Australia, you can remember that. All right, mate. Good day. And this is what it looks like. And this is in the dolutegravir studies. But just look at this. Within 2 weeks, boom, serum creatinine went up 0.1. milligrams per deciliter. So that's just kind of a nuance. It's a little bit beyond one. I'll repeat this exact same scenario so you can nap or go get some coffee when I go over this next time. And then the other recommended regimens are here. They're all fine. A lot of people are shying away from efavirenz these days because of the neurologic and the dream toxicity, if you will, or some increased depression. But it can be still used safely in a lot of patients, and we'll talk about that more in the later conversation about what to do with people who are still on it and should you switch. I've already mentioned the 100,000 here. And there's a fixed-dose combination of darunavir, cobicistat, TAF, and FTC. It's kind of a large pill, but it also is available for one pill once a day. All right, what do we do when there's an M184V at baseline? So a woman shows up, newly diagnosed, not pregnant, viral load's 128,000, CD4 count 350, B57 negative, M184V and a K103N, just to make it interesting. She's okay to start therapy if you think she should. Here's that same list. Try to make it easy. So go ahead and vote of what you might do here with a M184V and a K103N. I feel like I've got to play Sweet Home Alabama and say, turn it up, right? Okay, let's see what we got. All right, here there are a couple of answers that suddenly have become wrong. In particular, this guy, do not use this, the Diatec over 3TC, if there's an M184V. Do not use that. We've already talked about you're not going to use rilpivirine. Here, the 103N still might allow activity of rilpivirine, but we're above 100,000. But the rest of these ought to work just fine. And that's maybe the take-home point, that the M184V alone is not enough to sort of mess up an integrase inhibitor regimen. And so even if you're using FTC or 3TC, there's still some partial activity of those drugs, and the potency of the anchor drug is strong enough when combined with both, either TAF, FTC. I might shy away a little bit from, if the viral load's really high, abacavir also has hit some with this, but on the other hand, that probably is going to work okay, but there's a little bit of a hit to abacavir. There's a pretty strong hit to 3TC. The dolutegravir will still work, of course, but that might be a little bit more less robust than perhaps this regimen with dolutegravir, TAF, and FTC. So what are the recommendations for switching with virologic failure? You should confirm it, of course, because sometimes there's a bit of a blip. The dolutegravir with two nukes is generally what's used next, or in this case, bictegravir would be just fine. A boosted PI oftentimes will work, but you want to make sure that there's no resistance mutations there. And then sometimes with one fully active agent alone, but you want to use the dolutegravir twice daily in that setting if you only have one fully active agent to pair with it. These really hadn't changed; those recommendations hadn't changed in the last several years. What about laboratory monitoring? Well, here's where some new things happened in the IAS-USA guidelines that did not yet, that may happen in the, we'll see what happens with HHS. But the usual things we do ahead of time, it's just listed there for you. You can read it and look at it later. But I think those are the things that most of us do. Genotype testing for RT and protease. Now, I've gotten some feedback, because I was a part of that panel, that, okay, why don't we screen normally just for integrase inhibitor at baseline? The answer would be the same as it's been for all other drugs. It's when your local region is seeing transmitted integrase above pretty much 2%, 1% to 2%, then you might start doing it. As a rule, we're not seeing that. So I got a letter from somebody that said, oh, here's a case of someone who had that. Okay, one case. So you're going to create policy off of one case? Probably not. So you just sort of need to monitor, know your region. CDC is continuing to follow this type of thing. But right now, routine testing for all patients for strand transfer integrase inhibitors is not recommended. And then the B5701 is a good thing just to get at baseline in case you want to go back and use that. CCR5 tropism, pretty much only when you anticipate you're going to be using maraviroc. And this is just a summary that's in the guidance, and you can check that out, but it's pretty much everything I said. Here's where there's some changes. This is the same, monitor viral load every 3 months until the virus is suppressed. But CD4 counts every 6 months until the counts are above 250 for at least a year when the patient has sustained virologic suppression. You say, well, why is that? Well, let me ask you a question. In your practice, if you've had somebody who's had suppressed virus for the last 8 years, and their CD4 count, let's pick a number, has been 550 or higher, have you done anything with that CD4 data at all? I mean, you give them the number, and maybe they'll say at their cocktail party, hey, my CD4 count's above 1,000 now. Okay, good. Great. Have another soda. I mean, so we don't use it, and it's an expensive test. For those of us in the Ryan White clinics, which is everybody in this room, we're still being asked to provide it. So what we've done is we've stopped checking, and we write a note in the chart that says, recent guidelines suggest not checking this. Now, we'll see how that plays out as our monitors come. So we'll be the vanguard, and I'll let you know how it goes as our funding gets pulled. Yeah, well, she's in the audience. She hears us. But we're not doing it anymore because it's saving money, and it's hard to argue with that. And then STI screening, and of course, and the rest. And repeating, if you have a detectable virus, repeat in 4 weeks or so and try to confirm that it's not a blip. We'll talk in a minute about somebody who has sustained viral load that doesn't come down. It was one of the questions earlier. I think I'm going to get to that. So what should I use in a pregnant patient? 30-year-old, same lady as earlier, except this time when she's diagnosed, she's 2.5 months pregnant. Her other labs are negative. And this is her first pregnancy. You want to start her on something. What are you going to use? 2.5 months. That's 10 weeks. Go ahead and vote. Trick question. So we're gonna go over this exact same thing with real experts in the room, not me, folks who know a lot about this. Let's go ahead and see where we are. Okay, nice smattering. Now, a lot of you are going to say, wait a minute, I can't use dolutegravir. At 10 weeks, it probably doesn't matter, right? Because the neural tube issues are what's at play, and those are formed by 6 weeks. So the people that, it's kind of a catch-22, isn't it? So in some ways you might, in a woman who is considering pregnancy or is in the pregnancy years, who might become pregnant, you might not want to start dolutegravir up front. For the time being, I want to underscore that 12 times. Because just a little bit of a preview of coming attractions, the follow-up data from the African study are showing that the effect size is dropping. In other words, it's not quite as dramatic as they get more data. And this reminds me an awful lot of what we went through with the efavirenz and had that initial shock, and it was the exact same problem. Right, it was neural tube things. So stay tuned. The sad part is that we've gone through all these maturations and hoops that we've jumped through to get patients off of dolutegravir. It may not matter, but for right now, it still matters. And as of this week, when the new guidelines came out, those are the recommendations, is to try to avoid it. But the other things, I think one thing to keep in mind is that efavirenz is still a good choice here, but not TAF yet, okay? So that pretest question that most of you got wrong, people were putting TAF was an okay choice, it's really not okay. Bictegravir is an okay choice, it's really not okay. Cobicistat is an okay choice, nope, not okay. So we're still pretty much restricted to TDF, FTC is fine, boosted atazanavir, great, efavirenz, good. But we can't use these advanced strand transfers, except you can use raltegravir. That's just fine. So we're going to go over this more later in the meeting. And this is that big effect size, which is, based on data I'm hearing, is dropping down pretty substantially now. Should I change a regimen when the viral load is detectable? That's what I said we get to. Here we are. 55-year-old guy is referred to you, diagnosed 18 years ago. Initial viral load was really high, almost a million, had a low CD4 count. His current viral load is 85 copies. Prior value was 62. CD4 counts recovered after over 18 years, although it took a while. It was a slow takeoff. And he's been on a bunch of different regimens, but now he's on dolutegravir, darunavir boosted with 3TC. So what are you going to do? Are you going to change his regimen, not change his regimen? Not sure. Go ahead and vote. This is another question we'll do later, so we'll hear the panel's commentary. Okay. Right. I would agree with that. If I change, I don't know what I'm going to change to, and I guarantee you it won't change his viral load. You can even add a drug to it. It ain't going to change his viral load. Why? Biology. Okay? The basic biology of HIV is that, and we got to this in one of the questions to David, those, and I think it was a question from the floor as well, people that have come in with a very high baseline HIV RNA pre-treatment, they have a huge number of reservoir cells, let's call them. And because viral load is directly proportional to the number of cells in the body producing virus. Viral load is proportional to the number of cells in the body producing virus. And remember that those cells that are actively producing typically live only about a day, and then they're destroyed, and then they're replaced by precisely one new cell infected before there's treatment. You give treatment, whack, you stop that completely. And Silicon will talk about that in about 2 hours. In my opinion and his opinion and a lot of other, there is no subtle ongoing replication in the background smoldering. That doesn't happen. Antiretroviral therapy works. The reason I would say that is data that Silicon has, but also if there was some smoldering ongoing replication, over time, what you should see is emergence of a resistant virus. That should happen. It doesn't happen. So what is the viral load coming from? It's coming from those residual reservoir cells that get stimulated every now and then to spit out some virus. And at baseline, if you had a lot of those cells, like you do when somebody has a very high viral load at baseline pre-treatment, you get this like little symphony of spitting out virus here and there, and it becomes detectable. Nothing you can do about it until we have cure therapy. So forget about it. You don't have to worry about it. You're going to be okay. So here's a blip. That's a little different. That might be somebody who's on suppression, gets, say, the flu or something or some other big stimulus, and now it becomes detectable above 50 or above 25 or something. But just move that line up for people that have had a high baseline viral load and a lot of reservoir cells. That's kind of the point. When it gets above 200,000, when it gets above 200, then you should be worried. That's not normal. That's a sign that they're actually headed towards virologic failure. Sometimes a simple conversation, hey, did you miss any meds or what's going on? You can solve that. They go back on their regimen regularly and it comes back down. This is where I'm trying to make the point I said earlier. Here's the normal life cycle of HIV replication, 1 billion to 10 billion viruses produced a day coming from this pool of cells pre-therapy. And when in steady state, the viral load is proportional to the number of cells in the body producing virus. When you give antiretroviral therapy, you stop the infection of these activated CD4 cells, and these cells die off. They're not replaced. Viral load plummets. But these guys over here, these chronically latently infected cells, I called them earlier reservoir cells, live on. And originally we thought their half-life was 14 days. Uh-uh. That was really way too optimistic. It's probably about 80 months. But every time they replicate or they form daughter cells, the virus goes right with them. And so these cells can periodically be stimulated and kick out some virus, so I probably should update this slide to really illustrate that. But that's the key point about HIV pathogenesis and viral dynamics. And finally, how should I counsel a patient about with undetectable HIV RNA over years about their transmission risk to other people? We'll go over this question again with the panel, but just for us right now, a guy comes in, he basically goes on therapy, his viral load gets suppressed. Assuming he remains undetectable from that point forward and he keeps taking his medicine, you tell him that his risk of transmitting HIV to a seronegative partner via sex is zero, virtually zero, very low risk, possible, depends on what regimen, come on, SAG. I don't like this question. I Yeah, I agree with you. So it's all in semantics, right? We'll go over more data and have the experts talk with us tomorrow afternoon or morning, late morning, when we do the full panel. But zero risk under these circumstances is probably correct. Virtually zero if you're not one of those kind of leap takers. If you just sort of say, don't worry about it, that's probably okay. But if you're a little bit more precise, you're more like an accountant, right, or a pharmacist, everything really matters, details matter, then virtually would be. But I think we're better than very low risk. We're better than that right now. And the way that I know that, or we know that, the way that we know that is because of, there we go, is this study. This is there's a series of studies that basically look at the partner studies where they looked at serodiscordant couples, and they had 77,000 plus exposures, and nobody got infected from their seropositive partner to the seronegative. No one. Now, there were a couple of cases of transmission. Somebody, seronegative partner, did become infected. But when they did the genetics of the virus, it didn't come from their regular partner. Now, that's fun counseling right there. And this is where the virtual versus real, when you have zero as your outcome, then you're looking at the upper end of the confidence interval, and that depends on numbers of patients followed over a period of time. So that's why virtually zero is probably the absolute correct answer, and undetectable equals untransmissible, and we'll close. So these are the summary slide, and I'll go ahead and stop here for questions. Thanks.
I have a question. Thank you so much for your talk. So my questions are specifically about bictegravir. In your audience response questions. So in one, asking about the woman of childbearing potential, you said you it was not okay to use bictegravir. My question is, why is there data about that, or just because of the structural similarity to dolutegravir? Because a lot of these women we want to change over from their STR with dolutegravir, and I feel very limited by the other STRs that are available, and I feel like they're being punished, changing to these multi-pill regimens.
Yeah, I got you.
And then the second question is about bictegravir use in a patient with an M184V mutation, and if there's data about that.
I'm sorry, bictegravir for?
In the M184V case.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, there are data. Yeah. The second part, yes. There are data, especially from cohort studies and others, that show that it works pretty much as well. So I wouldn't worry about the M184V alone. As far as the other, life has always been unfair to pregnant women. I mean, seriously. And perhaps women in general. The point is that the FDA in particular, and I guess for good reason, is concerned about teratogenicity and trouble with drugs. And when there are no data, they default to don't use it unless you absolutely have to. So there just aren't enough data. Now, you could also argue, the structural similarities show that. But take dolutegravir as an example. It's one that there was some emerging data that looked pretty good, so they gave it a stamp of approval, started using it. Then you go to Botswana, and it starts being used big time, and they see some neural tube defects. But I will say that the actual number of cases is very, very, very small. But you see some, you get a signal, and everyone goes, because it's a kid, and it's an infant, and it's a mom. I'll work with you on it, but I those are just what the recommendations are. But you're right, it's unfair. Yes.
Thanks for your talk and, for years of helping all of us. Thank you. So, Mike, I'm an old-time doc, so I do want to be one of the people to ask you about the CD4 cell changes in our monitoring. So we do CD4 counts in order to protect our patients against opportunistic infections, which we start to forget about, a lot lately. And our patients, thank goodness, are now able to take, as we mentioned before, biologicals, chemotherapy, and solid organ transplants. And that really lowers their CD4 counts. So at least we need the little asterisk to say with stable clinical conditions, you can change your monitoring for CD4. But otherwise, in other clinical conditions, you need to continue it.
Agree.
Okay.
Yeah. So the guidelines are meant for the routine, ordinary stuff. But when you're right, when somebody goes on chemotherapy or biologic, all bets are off. Then and then you're back to perhaps even prophylaxing, because some chemotherapy drops CD4 counts, and you're going to probably want to use trim sulfa or something. But you're right. So it also meant 250 or higher, right? So if you're doing something that's going to put somebody at higher risk, that's common sense. You know, I always ask the question, who are the guidelines for? Who do we write guidelines for? I would argue pretty much not the people in this room, because you know the details. The guidelines are maybe for somebody just starting, or maybe for students. It's certainly for payers, right? It's certainly for payers. And the pharmaceutical companies pay a lot of attention to it for reasons I can't quite understand. Just kidding. They mark it off of them. But other than that, you guys, I mean, you use them mostly as something to say, yeah, I agree with it, or I'll rail at it. But they're guidelines. They're not directives. They're not requirements. They're not saying, it's just saying this is what a panel thinks is reasonable. And then we go from there. Yeah.
My question, when you said you start to see this, the viral load go up to over 200, add another drug, I'm just curious, do you wait until you can get a genotype that's accurate?
Because I didn't mean to say if it goes above 200, add another drug.
Well, if it stays, you start to see a compliant patient all of a sudden go to 200, 300. You know, their viral load's going up, and they're completely compliant, and now you're starting to wonder if they have resistance. Not having any luck with an archived genotype, because it's, of course, showing me no resistance to anything.
Okay.
Do you wait till they're over 1,000 to get a more accurate genotype, or what do you normally do?
Okay, I get your question. Let me clarify a couple things. What I was trying to communicate was, if the viral load is just hovering at 80 or 90, that's not something to worry about. When it goes above 200, then you should pay attention. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the first point. Second point, sometimes it went above 200 because the patient had a bad week, and they're coming in to see you, and you talk to them, and they say, go back on your medicine, we'll recheck in 4 weeks, and then come back in 4 weeks, and everything's fine. That's not what we're talking about. So when it goes above 200, and then I repeat it, and let's say it comes back at 500, your next question is, should I get a genotype then, or should I wait? I'd go ahead and get it now. It's not an issue of completeness of genotype. It's a question of whether there's enough virus there that the company that's doing the genotype can amplify the virus. Once they get an amplified virus, the genotype's just fine. So the risk you take, if the viral load's a little bit low, like 450, if you can go ahead and send it off, you might end up getting an answer back. Test couldn't be completed because we couldn't get an amplification. Then you just try to repeat it again in the viral load's higher. But the reason I'd go ahead and send it, even if it's, let's say, 500 copies, is because oftentimes they can amplify and you'll get an answer. And then you can switch them to a regimen sooner before more mutations accumulate. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So similarly, someone had asked if someone had a CD4 count, a low CD, came in late, low CD4 count, got a viral load less than 20 once, and then it's persistently less than 200, but their CD4 count isn't going up. Mm. At what point would you consider either doing an archival, or some archival genotype, or otherwise changing their regimen to try to boost their CD4, given this sort of persistently low detectable viral load?
Yeah, that's a really important question. Okay, let's back up a step and say, what does an antiviral do? It treats the virus. So your answer in terms of their viral load coming down to 20 or something says the drug is working. So there's nothing more. Adding another drug ain't going to change the antiviral activity. Switching to another regimen ain't going to likely do better as far as CD4 count, unless the drug you're using is toxic to white cells, which could happen. AZT does that, but we don't use that anymore. So let's go back and ask, well, why is it that CD4 counts don't bump. And let me kind of quickly go through that. And it somehow, it nicely plays into the question that David got about Galt, right? About what happens when acute infection happens. Typically, when somebody has late-stage disease, they have burned out their lymphatic tissue. So think Paradise, California, right, after the fire. That's what these lymph nodes look like on the inside. It's charred. It's from all this inflammation. Whew. And normally, lymphocytes are kind of way stations for, lymph nodes are way stations for lymphocytes as they travel around the body. It's kind of like their train station or their local pub. They come in, have a drink, talk to people, and then they're back out in the circulation like truck drivers or something, right? But if they don't have a place to congregate in the lymph node or the lymphatic tissue, they're just floating around. So what happens typically in a normal situation when the lymphatic tissue is intact and the cells are going there for their pub, when you give antiretroviral therapy, what's keeping a lot of those cells in the lymph node is adhesion molecules called ICAM and VCAM that are elaborated because of inflammation from the replication. You stop the replication, ICAM and VCAM go away in a matter of days to a week or two, and those cells that are trapped in there, whew, go back. And so by week six, you'll see a bump in normal situations of a CD4 count from, let's say, 50 to 250 in 6 weeks. That's normal. There are a group of patients, however, like the question's asking, that stay around 50 or 60 and don't bump. Those are people whose lymphatic tissue has been destroyed and there just is no release, and you will never see that bump, no matter what drugs you give. And it's just the phenomena associated with that individual. And it can get back, but it's just the regular replacement of CD4 cells, which takes a long time. So you miss that redistribution bump, you will not see that. You'll have a discordant CD4 response. Changing medicine won't change that biology.
But what about the persistent viral load of 150, 100?
It's not all that common to have viral loads bubbling at 150. They usually bubble below 100. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I worry more if it's at 150 or closer to 200 that there's intermittent adherence, and then you can get resistance, and then you've got trouble. But see, viral loads of 150 as a rule in somebody taking their medicines regularly in an active regimen isn't an ordinary situation. So I would be more worried about the regimen at that point.
And for the U equals U, is that less than 200 or less than 20 based on the studies?
Sorry, the viral load being less than 200?
Less than 200 or less than 20? When you say this, the U equals U and the data.
It's usually, I don't know, it's less than 50 for sure.
No.
But here's where some of the other data come from. There was a study in 2001 in Rakai, before there was ever antiretroviral therapy with serodiscordant couples, and there was no transmission among the discordant couples as long as the baseline viral load was less than 1,000. So I'm not going to say go with 1,000, but I think as long as it's normally suppressed, let's say below 100, below 80, they're not going to transmit. If you call them suppressed, then and there's no ongoing replication, it's highly unlikely they're going to transmit.
And can you just talk about the two regimens that you'd recommend for pregnant women, and then whether Complera would be something you would use, and raltegravir?
Okay, raltegravir, yes. Complera can work. And Karen will get to this in her talk. We'll hear more about this during the meeting. I think that atazanavir-based regimens work. I just would stay away from, for now, till the data come out. TAF likely will be safe, but it hadn't been certified yet, so I wouldn't use that.
So a woman who gets pregnant on TAF, would you change her to TDF?
Probably, at least for the time being. Although we have experts, you wouldn't change them. All right, keep them on it. We'll hear. This is a better question for somebody who really knows what they're talking about.
I was just wondering, like, there was no conversation regarding the protease inhibitors. And personally, I get issues with the integrases and the metals. I mean, patients start popping some multivitamins and I start seeing some viral loads, like at that 150 mark,
right,
where I'm not seeing that with the PIs, especially in a young patient who doesn't have a lot of comorbidities, so I don't have to worry about other drugs.
Yeah, so the question is about chelation of antacids, and that does interfere with integrase inhibitors. So you got to look for that. And protease inhibitors are fine. It's not that they're not recommended. They're just not the recommended first line, but they're alternatives, and they're fine. If you're comfortable using them, go for it. I think what people are a little bit cautious about is the boosting agent, and that leaves a little bit less tolerability, so that if you look at that 90% success rate, 92%, it's usually 80% with, say, even darunavir. And that's mostly because of tolerability, not because the drug doesn't work. It's just people have trouble taking it. So if you have people who are on it and they're doing well and they're taking it and there's no drug-drug interactions, great.
Okay, thank you for your brilliant presentation. Dolutegravir and cobicistat change the level of creatinine by increasing the secretion, right?
Cobicistat decreases?
Increases
creatinine.
Cobicistat
just
and
a titch.
Dolutegravir.
Just a titch.
Okay,
right.
Okay, different.
Right.
But the basal membrane of the glomerula are still normal.
Right. So the glomerulus is totally normal. Right? And it's working. Where we're talking about is a little bit downstream in the proximal tubule, mm-hmm. in the cells of the proximal tubule. On one side is blood, on the other side is urine. And inside the proximal tubule cell are enzymes, transport enzymes, that OCT2 or MATE1. And OCT2 can be inhibited by dolutegravir and bictegravir. MATE1 can be inhibited by cobicistat. And if you inhibit either one, you will get less secretion, not filtration, less secretion of creatinine from the bloodstream into the urine. And that's why you see a little bit of bump. The reason I tell you that is don't worry about it. Expect it and don't do anything different.
Okay.
That's the reason we did that.
What if you had dolutegravir and a cobicistat together?
Dolutegravir.
Is it additive?
No, not that I know of, because dolutegravir... That I don't know. I don't know the answer to that if you use them together. But I'm not sure. Well, I guess we use it together some in the DD double. I don't think it has that much more of an effect. I'd have to look that up. I don't know.
So in other words, any patient with kidney failure, we don't need to consider this particular hemodynamic consideration when you are choosing the regimen.
Yeah, I think the take-home point is expect it and don't think of it as being a GFR problem. That's the take-home point.
One last question before we end. So some patients are asking about increased weight gain with TAF versus TDF. Do you know anything about that?
No. There's been a lot of talk. You name the antiretroviral, and they said it causes weight gain, right? I don't know of any specific data that says it's one drug or another. I can be a little cynical and say they're like me, and in my case, I eat a little bit too much, and that's a problem. But I don't think it could be improved well-being, but I don't think it's a drug effect per se. But you will see studies of dolutegravir that shows weight gain. I saw one study with bictegravir. I'm not sure it's the drug. I think it maybe just is better well-being.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks.
Thank you very much.